solve large, intractable problems.
It's a new venture altogether.
Your brain is a wild horse there.
Because remember, writing is not a team sport.
You are not selling horse carriages when there are cars.
I want to be known only as a trusted advisor.
More like a tourist.
Play to Potential Podcast.
And this goes back several years now, but one of my longtime athletes and now developed into very good friends, Sir Michael Moritz, who's a very well-known venture capitalist in the Bay Area, and was the chairman of Sequoia Capital. When he arrived to Purple Patch and we started working with him, his quest was, I want to become a better cyclist. And he had a wonderful goal. He said, my goal or my mission is to reach 90% of my potential. And when you first hear that, that might sound defeatist. But really what he was saying is, I want to maximize my return on investment within context of everything else that I have in my life. And obviously a very busy person with travel and a lot of responsibility in the workplace. But over the course of the development of becoming a cyclist, we integrated something that was really critical for him, strength and conditioning training. And we also introduced him to swimming. And at the time, he could barely swim. But that forced growth of developing in where he was passionate cycling, but then introducing swimming, it opened up his journey. And he started to join the dots back to what it takes to be a high-functioning executive. And we've spent a lot of time talking about this, of the benefits of multi-sport to link back to, in many ways, the workplace, or I would even make it grander than that, what it takes to be successful in life.
Welcome to the 46th conversation at the Play to Potential podcast. This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman here. I'm an executive coach, and I work with leaders during high-stakes transitions, whether it's related to an organizational context or a leader's career. I feel just like companies need to be coherent about the two questions, where to play and how to win, in the context of their strategy. We all need to be clear about our responses to the two questions, where to go and how to grow, at various points in time. I work with leaders to address those two questions, especially during key points of transition as they go through their journeys. In this podcast series, I talk to leaders from different domains, CEOs, sportsmen, artists, thought leaders, coaches, and so on three broad themes: leadership, transitions, and careers. And I apologize, I've been off the grid for the last few weeks. I just got back from my summer break in London, where I'd studied and worked for several years. Before I get on to the next guest of this podcast, I should mention that I'm excited about the lineup of the podcast guests in the coming weeks. In the pipeline, we have Paddy Upton, the mental conditioning coach of the Indian cricket team that won the ICC Cricket World Cup in 2011. Quite a timely topic given what we saw at Wimbledon and in the finals between New Zealand and England. Professor Herminia Ibarra, professor at London Business School and one of the leading thinkers in the space of leadership transitions and how leaders can reinvent themselves. Professor Linda Grattan, also a professor at London Business School and author of the book 100 Year Life, and how leaders should think about staying relevant in a world where they possibly have to work till their 70s and 80s. As you would have guessed, I took the opportunity of catching up with Herminia and Linda in person when I was in London. I also have Alan Eagle coming up, co-author of the book Trillion Dollar Coach, an insight into the methods of Bill Campbell, who's coached the who's who of Silicon Valley. Tasha Urick, author of the book Insight and one of the leading thinkers in the space of self-awareness. So stay tuned for all this coming your way in the next few weeks. But now let me get to the episode at hand and talk about the guest in this podcast conversation, Matt Dixon. Matt is an Ironman University master coach, former professional triathlete, author of two books, Fast Track Triathlete and Well-Built Triathlete, and he now runs Purple Patch Fitness that provides customized coaching for athletes across all levels. Purple Patch Fitness has coached multiple world champions, and their professional athletes have amassed over 400 Ironman and Ironman 70.3 wins and podiums. On the other side of the spectrum, they also work with time-starved CEOs and business leaders such as Sir Michael Moritz of Sequoia Capital, Mark Pincus, the founder of gaming company Zynga, just to name a few. Without further ado, let's dive into the conversation with Matt Dixon. Matt, welcome to the Play to Potential podcast. Really excited to be talking to you.
Thanks so much, Deepak. Very much so as well.
And for the purpose of listeners, why don't we start with you talking about what you do, but more importantly, give us a sense of why you do what you do.
Sure. Well, I think to really understand what I do, I think we have to talk about my favorite subject, myself. And my background is, I'm an exercise physiologist, but also an elite athlete. And without belaboring the journey of my athletic career, it suffice to say, I think I'm a wonderful example of how to do a professional triathlon career very poorly. And this is now going back 15 years, but I managed to train myself into the ground, ignoring some key positive habits that I think are fundamental for performance for elite athletes, but also for everyday people. And it was my journey that sort of was the catalyst in many ways for me to look at the sport at the time, myself being a triathlon coach, an endurance coach, and just think there's got to be a better way. And I came up with started to develop out of this a methodology, a way of thinking to help endurance athletes. But as we have gone on our journey, that we've had a lot of success with our endurance athletes and professional athletes, but it's really born into our company now, Purple Patch, in which we really help people find their human potential. In fact, the mission of the company is to educate and empower people to find their athletic potential. And that's through the lens that when you find your athletic potential, you're on your way to reaching your human potential. And so that's really what the company and myself does.
Wonderful. And talk to us a little bit about the kind of people that train with you today at Purple Patch.
We have a wide spectrum. And I think the common thread between them all is the desire to improve. But at one end of the continuum, we have people that are unapologetically going after world-class performance, professional athletes, some of the very best Ironman athletes in the world, in fact, multiple world champions. And then, of course, under that umbrella, we have very obsessive amateur triathletes, but all the way down to the other end, where it's people just looking to integrate sport into their life so that they can not only achieve results in sport, but thrive in the other critical elements, their health, their performance at work, and the version of themselves that they bring to their family and friends. So that tends to become very, very busy CEOs and executives that are looking to thrive across life.
Got it. And just to maybe pick two archetypes, right, in the people that you train. On one end, you have world-class triathletes. On the other end, you have time-starved CEOs and founders in the Valley. Mm-hmm. And other places. So in what ways is coaching these two groups similar, and in what ways is it different? Give us a sense of how you think about coaching in each of these two situations.
Sure. Well, I think it's interesting because we sort of have our visions of what it takes to be a really successful CEO and a really successful professional athlete. But one of the things I'd first point out is that toughness is not a differentiator. And so people that are successful, it's a prerequisite to be tough. And that's the most obvious thing. What we see with working with these types of athletes and these types of CEOs is there tend to be a set of very common traits or personality traits or ways of thinking that ultimately develop success for them. And we bucket those into four main categories. The first is that they all operate within a framework. And these are the most obvious piece, but they all have a North Star vision. They all love a journey. They have a massive intentional focus for consistency. And so when we think about that, all of these people are habit-driven. They have big picture thinking. So they have a great ability to come out of the weeds, both the professional athletes and the CEOs. But the thing that I find, the two elements that I find very similar always, are that there is a thirst for coaching. And so both populations really require, cry out for accountability and feedback, but have humility to be coached. And I think that's a really interesting one, because people think about successful people as just being great leaders driving from the front. But in fact, leaders need leaders, and they tend to be the most humble and thirsty for knowledge, really understanding the why. And the final component is that they are what we call at Purple Patch change able. And we understand that the journey to performance is never linear. And so there has to be this amazing resilience and adaptability within both populations. When we think about the professional athlete, the interesting thing is, in many ways, those athletes are looking after or looking for world-class performance, manage it within much more chaos, which is typically life, including family and travel and other aspects such as that.
Got it. Let's pick up with one of the pieces you spoke about, Matt, people being change-able, right? Mm-hmm. And you spoke about that being a common thread across elite athletes and successful leaders. How do you suss that out? You know, as you think about the people that you take on at Purple Patch, what sort of people do you say no to?
Well, I think that firstly, I'd say we have to acknowledge a couple of things. The first is that change is hard. And in fact, even when change is a positive thing, it's a real challenge for people. And you mentioned at the end there, how do we say no to people? How do we suss out the question? How do we suss out whether they're changeable? I actually believe that developing adaptability and resilience, which is the heartbeat of being changeable, is a learnable skill. And so the first component is really looking at not, oh, do they have these characteristics and are they just there, similar to some God-given gift or something like that? But instead, what we really look at is, do they value coaching? Do they have the ability to rise up and create perspective? And are they immersed in the positive component of requiring accountability and feedback? And so really what I look for people is, do they have humility to be coached? Is this someone that is a person that leads with, and I always say this, do you lead with more questions than just trying to provide the solution? And a common phrase that we all know nowadays, a growth mindset. But is this athlete, or particularly is this CEO, do they want to understand the why behind it? And people that want to just follow a plan, that just want to be spoon-fed, that doesn't suggest a characteristic of adaptability. It's simply box-checking. And therefore, I would say not only are they less equipped to become a great CEO and executive, they're certainly not going to improve in the sporting component of life in the way that they could.
Got it. So I guess if I were to make sense of what you said, there's certain curiosity towards, you know, the next level of detail, not just the sticking to the plan or just blindly following it, but really showing a healthy curiosity towards what's behind it, is what I'm picking up.
Exactly. That word curiosity is a wonderful word. And, you know, in an athletic sense, imagine if one of your listeners was training for Ironman Goa or Ironman Turkey, one of these triathletes that are becoming more popular in the area, and all they want is a plan. Just tell me what to do as a central baseline characteristic. Mm-hmm. That's box checking. And the characteristic that is going to separate those that follow a plan and do well because it's a smart plan and they excel, and the people that are going to really thrive, really shine, are the people that actually look at the plan and say, how does this fit into my life? What's the meaning? What are we looking to accomplish out of this? So that ultimately from the plan, they're creating mission, saying, I understand what my purpose is. And from there, a whole thing start to become unpacked. And really what it creates within that person is empowerment. And the same applies for a CEO. And if a very busy executive comes and just says, great, I'm going to get a coach. Give me the fairy dust. Give me the magic. That's never going to be ultimately the most successful relationship, because pure excellence and development in any area in life is going to come from intrinsically the person, and any coach is going to drive them by setting the path, not just and helping them, guide them along the way, not just saying, this is what you should do because I said it.
Got it. And moving to a slightly different topic, a related topic rather, Matt, what have you learned about the coach-coachee fit, if I may use the term? Different athletes require different styles of coaching and different types of coaches. So in your experience at Purple Patch and as an athlete yourself, how do you think about finding the right fit now at Purple Patch? How do you think about it?
Well, it's something that we talk about a lot, Deepak, with the acknowledgement that I am not for everyone, we are not for everyone. And there are obviously different styles of coaching. But I think at the heart of it, in many ways, the question is, what is the most successful style of coaching that is always present? Or what are the key components of an effective coaching relationship? And I think that it's very different to coach young children versus adults. So if we decide that we're going to be coaching adults, which is what we're talking about here, we have to acknowledge that hopefully that adult is evolved. When you're coaching a very small child, they don't have the wisdom, the capability for critical thinking, really the opportunity to contribute in a meaningful way. And so our job as parents or as coaches of children is to block and tackle and sort of be a very direct coaching methodology. But if we answer the question in terms of adults, there's always a component that we're looking for collaboration, not a dictatorship. And so I think that it's really important for both coachee and coach to realize that they both have a role to play in the partnership. And what that means is that there has to be communication and accountability on both sides. So beyond the main pursuit, we have to really look to centers to put at the center that the key is honesty and truth and ensure that there is communication happening. And I think that's the critical component for the coach to find whether they can communicate with the athlete or the person that they're guiding, but also the coachee to understand and acknowledge that they have a role to play in that pursuit as well. And I think that's a really critical element of finding the appropriate coach for you ultimately.
And in one of the conversations as I was doing the research for this podcast, Matt, you talk about the coach's openness to being coached as one of the elements of a successful coach-coachee relationship. And I found that fascinating, right? We often see this as a one-way street where the coach is coaching the coachee, but I really liked the way you framed it, saying, you know, even the coach needs to be open to receiving coaching. So talk to us a little bit about how that plays out in the Purple Patch context.
Sure, yeah, that's... I think that's a fundamental tenet of how I go about coaching in many ways, Deepak, and I think that it really fits in two channels. The first is the same as a characteristic for a CEO, an executive, a world-class athlete, is always thirsty for growth and is always looking to understand why and develop. And quite often, as you say, people come to coaches and think that they should have all of the answers. And so the coach ends up in faux confidence, often standing up almost like the Wizard of Oz and saying, this is how you should do it. But the truth is that the coach is dead in the water if as soon as they start thinking they have all of the solutions. And so the first part of it is a coach's quest to really try and surround yourself in experts in particular areas of fields that you can draw from to help your own personal growth. in the same way as if leaders need leaders and then coaches need coaches. And all the time I apply and realize, hang on, it's not my role to be an expert in every domain of performance. So in my world, that might be nutrition or sleep or time zone adjustment physiology or strength and conditioning, whatever the components might be. It's much better for me to learn and evolve and draw from experts in their field and go and talk to the leading neurologists so that I can draw and understand more about sleep quality so that then I can filter and apply and put in context for my athletes and CEOs. So there's that part of personal growth. But a second part of growth also comes from the people that you are leading. And probably the most valuable lessons that I've received as a coach is from observation and from understanding and from listening to my athletes and CEOs. And that comes for me personally in two areas. And that's that thing called wisdom in coaching. But as a coach, you can only grow and learn through observation and listening if you are listening and if you ask questions. And so effective coaching for me isn't just telling people what to do. And that's why I come back to that collaboration standpoint. You have to have the courage and the vulnerability, which I think is actually a strength, to ask questions, to see how they feel, to find their perspective, and then to look and observe and grow. And so the only way to be an effective leader or coach is to always be in the pursuit of learning, even though ultimately you're the one setting the path. And I guess the final component that I might say is with many people that I work with, let's take a leading CEO, very busy, has a highly complex life, and they come to me to help inject fitness, health, and all of the habits around performance and health into their life. And so I'm educating, I'm empowering, I'm creating a solution that can integrate into their life so that they improve. At the same time, I'm looking to draw from the lessons and the behaviors because ultimately they're successful in something parallel. And so it's always an opportunity to look and learn and observe. But if I'm just broadcasting, I'm never going to achieve that rich reward as a coach.
Got it. Just shifting focus back to your personal journey, Matt. You moved from being an athlete to being a coach, right? And from being a coach to being a leader of coaches at Purple Patch. So talk to us about both these transitions, right? What's been easy, what's been hard for you to transition from each of these orbits to reinvent yourself along the way?
Yeah, it's a funny journey as you look back now, but I think that I have gone through a few transitions. The first was obviously athlete and then transition to coach and then coach to small business owner and then small business owner to CEO all at the same time being a coach. It has been a challenge. It always is. And I think the journey to whatever one's performance is never linear, and there are going to be mistakes on the way, but it's that adaptability and resilience that I think have been at the backbone of it. I think with a transition from athlete to coach, it's a great question because in many ways the analogy that I would use is how do you become an employee that's really good at your role and suddenly become a great manager? And that's really what coaching is. And there's a reason that many great athletes ultimately are not very good coaches. In the same way as the best employee at a particular, the best data scientist might not become then a great manager. Because really what we're asking them to do, what I was asking myself to do, is to be a wonderful fighter pilot, but then suddenly become an instructor, an air traffic controller, and the emergency services. And ultimately, not all of us are equipped to do that. Many don't have the perspective and the ability to come out of the weeds and the, as we talked about before, the curiosity to understand the why behind the success. And ultimately, is for my challenge, the first thing that was the biggest challenge is elite sport is very self-centrist. It's almost an appropriately selfish quest. Coaching is not. And so what I had to draw on was taking myself out of becoming the driver, and over the course of time becoming more ironically humble, even though I was a leader. The interesting thing is, as then I had to make the second transition from coach to business owner and business leader, ultimately, and managing a team, not just of coaches, but of many different skill sets and roles, I was actually, I found that in many ways more intuitive. And I almost felt like in some components, I'd almost had my MBA through my elite athletics and professional career, and all of the characteristics that I had, and all I had to do was apply that combined with coaching, which is really management. And I just had to almost tilt the light towards that, draw on those characteristics. And I found that pathway ironically easier. And there were lots of things I had to learn around corporate structure and technology and things along those lines, which are the same as going into any business. But the actual characteristics of becoming a manager and what it takes to be successful as an entrepreneur, I could draw on my elite athletes. In fact, I understand why people love to hire athletes, because they have the traits not just of toughness, but they have those characteristics of excellence that ultimately is critical for success. And most of them are trained to be managed because they're trained to be coached.
And even going back to the second transition, Matt, moving from a coach to an entrepreneur and a leader of an organization that has several coaches working in it, how did you think about that choice? Because scale is a choice, and different people derive energy from different things. So how did you think about, Matt working with 10, 20, 30 people and really driving them to world-class performance versus Matt creating an organization that does this? Was that choice reasonably straightforward, or did you agonize over it?
I think there are two components that maybe sound like a paradox. The first is that I'm a competitive person, and I love the journey of development. And so as the path opened up, where there was almost in many ways a replacement for the passion of the process of becoming a world-class athlete, suddenly I saw a parallel journey. And so it tugged at my heartstrings. This is a wonderful challenge. It almost seemed impossible. And myself being English, where I grew up in a culture of go and get a real job and we don't belong, and almost a class system where, in the States, everyone believes something is possible. And so I actually needed to grow in confidence to take on that component, to actually say, hang on, I'm actually going to go and do this. But I think that the real push behind it is I saw a real need for it. I saw a solution or a problem that needed to be solved. And at that time, when I started Purple Patch, that problem is that I saw so many people at the time, all athletes, that were walking around in the fog of fatigue. And I felt like there was a different way. I felt like there had to be change. And so I think that when you see something that needs to be solved and you feel like you have the answer, there is a greater pull, or maybe a greater push, to step towards that. And it's very succinct. So I didn't actually start with, oh, I want to be a CEO, or I want to be an entrepreneur, and I want to. It was never sort of driven by finances. It was never driven by self-glorification or ego, even though ego can be a good thing and is important in many traits. It was driven by ultimately having a really positive impact on something that I think is quite important: how we operate in daily life and how we feel and the results we receive from the effort that we're putting into something. And out of that, then it has grown. And so, I think it's really twofold in many ways.
Got it. Moving to a different theme, Matt. You know, I'm sure you come across people that work with you, that train with you rather, who excel in one of the domains, let's say whether it's swimming or running or biking, and they come to you to train for a triathlon. I'm curious about the big shifts that people often need to make when they come from excellence in one domain, but now they need to be good at multiple domains. To me, at some level, it feels a bit like moving from a functional leadership role to general management in a company. So talk to me a little bit about what are some of the interesting things you observe as people make this transition from excellence in one space to being good at multiple things.
It's a great question. And I think that your analogy is absolutely perfect, because the interesting thing about multi-sport, you know, you've got a sport in which it's almost three individual sports, but ultimately it's not swimming, biking and running. The sport is three disciplines, swim, bike, run, and it creates one sport. So it's multi-sport, therefore it's multidisciplinary. And This is a very similar skill set that is required to be a high level executive. Multi-level functioning and emotional intelligence and executive functioning. And so it all becomes about intentional focus. The real benefit is that I've yet to meet anyone coming into embracing a multi-sport lifestyle in which they have a perfectly balanced set of skills. So if we use triathlon as the example, they are as strong as a swimmer and a cyclist and a runner. There is always one or two that are slightly stronger, and there's one or two that needs growth. And the interesting part about participating or going on a journey of this is it therefore creates an arena of forced growth. And very rarely in life, as we become adults, do we put ourselves in situations where we have to grow in an area of real weakness. And so often when people take this on, and they might be a very poor swimmer. Imagine somebody, again, coming back to preparing for my Ironman Goa, and they decide that that's going to be their first race that they're going to do in the sport. They're going to look at it, and the tendency is always going to be to fall towards their strengths. And the reason for that is that they're familiar. The strengths are familiar. But the necessity is to actually force growth in the weaknesses. Yes, rely on the strengths. Yes, continue to look to grow and magnify those and use them. But we have to actually see blind spots, see weaknesses, so that we can develop. So the interesting thing that we see almost every time working with an executive who comes in and starts to deploy a multi-sport lens, and it doesn't matter if it's triathlon or it's just multiple disciplines, they might be rowing and riding a spin bike and doing some strength training, whatever it might be, the development of weakness, it's very rare that they don't start to join the dots back to the requirements of themselves as being a really high-functioning executives and CEO. And if I can, I'll tell you a really brief story. And this goes back several years now, but one of my long-time athletes and now developed into very good friends, Sir Michael Moritz, who's a very well-known venture capitalist in the Bay Area and was the chairman of Sequoia Capital. When he arrived to Purple Patch and we started working with him, his quest was, I want to become a better cyclist. And he had a wonderful goal. He said, my goal or my mission is to reach 90% of my potential. And when you first hear that might sound defeatist, but really what he was saying is, I want to maximize my return on investment within context of everything else that I have in my life. And obviously a very busy person with travel and a lot of responsibility in the workplace. But over the course of the development of becoming a cyclist, we integrated something that was really critical for him, strength and conditioning training. And we also introduced him to swimming. And at the time, he could barely swim. But that forced growth of developing in where he was passionate cycling, but then introducing swimming, it opened up his journey. And he started to join the dots back to what it takes to be a high functioning executive. And we've spent a lot of time talking about this, of the benefits of multi-sport to link back to, in many ways, the workplace, or I would even make it grander than that, what it takes to be successful in life.
That's fascinating. If I may persist with this theme, Matt, I like the term forced growth, where you push on things which might possibly be a weakness. And you yourself said that it's not just about playing to your strengths, but in a world with finite time, how do you reconcile this with, let's say, the 10,000 hours number that's floating around, right? Thanks to Malcolm Gladwell, where he says, pick one or two things and get really good at it by spending a lot of time doing it. So in a world with finite time, how do you reconcile making time for forced growth versus maybe using that time for doubling down on something else where you're already distinctive? How do you think about that?
Well, I think that, you know, firstly, the 10,000 hours component is wonderfully hooky, and it's a lovely concept. And I think that the positive out of that messaging is it's a journey. So nothing happens in an instant gratification. It's almost the antithesis of that let's get what we need now mindset. And so, but unfortunately, it's a myth. 10,000 hours doesn't necessarily create excellence. And so it's wonderful, but it's a myth. But I understand the context behind it. And I think that the really critical component that comes out of it is, if you want to be excellent at anything, and then it is without doubt a journey. It is not going to happen quickly. It's going to take time. And therefore, the most success is going to arrive out of falling in love with the journey rather than just being outcome driven. And so I'll first say that about 10,000 hours. It's a great thing if you put it in context. But and let me also say that random collection of just doing a whole bunch of stuff is not necessarily is not going to yield results either. And so what I'm not suggesting here is, by saying multi-sport or multi-discipline, that doesn't mean that you have to go along the escalator of life and grab everything that is in touch with you. Focus is important, and intentional focus is critical. Understanding what the components that you have to focus on in order to give you biggest yield. But yes, if you want to become the best violinist in the world, and you are 8 years old and you only focus on violin, there's potentially a path for you to do that. And that might be critical. But if you are looking to become a high-functioning business leader, it is impossible in that scope of what it requires for it to be a singular strength to be really good at. So I would come back and I would argue that in order to become the best leader, the best CEO, the best executive, you have to ultimately not just be really good at the financial implications. You have to develop multidisciplinary approaches. And so I think you still have a narrow focus within the sporting world, but there's something wonderfully healthy about the multi-sport component, where it forces growth in an area, but it's still under a very particular, very narrow focus in many ways.
This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman here. I like what Matt says about what Sir Michael Moritz tells him when he joins Purple Patch Fitness. I want to play it back just to reiterate the point.
And this goes back several years now, but one of my longtime athletes and now developed into very good friends, Sir Michael Moritz, who's a very well-known venture capitalist in the Bay Area, and was the chairman of Sequoia Capital. When he arrived to Purple Patch and we started working with him, his quest was, I want to become a better cyclist. And he had a wonderful goal. He said, my goal or my mission is to reach 90% of my potential. And when you first hear that, that might sound defeatist. But really what he was saying is, I want to maximize my return on investment within context of everything else that I have in my life.
Now, let's get back to the conversation with Matt Dixon. Got it. No, that makes sense, Matt. And on a similar theme, if you look at the leaders, the business leaders that come to Purple Patch, and you use the term, you know, reach your athletic potential and through that discover your leadership potential or human potential. If we sort of explore that phrase for a minute and you look at the people that train with you, what is it about leadership that they don't know already? Do they pick up when they train with you, right? All these people are immensely successful. They've learned a lot about leadership, about business, about commerce by the time they come to you. But in your experience, what's the delta through the experience of discovering that athletic potential that they take back to their businesses?
I think I would anchor it in a very simple word, and it's going to sound like a cooking show, but the recipe. And I think what people are typically less equipped to execute on is drawing all of the components of their strengths and weaknesses and creating a sustainable recipe to ultimately create performance. And I'll give you an example. If we think about a model that we might apply for a world-class athlete, and you can picture a Venn diagram almost. We understand with a world-class athlete that when we get the appropriate endurance training program and it is supported with strength and conditioning, a backbone of really positive nutrition habits and enough recovery to enable the positive effect of their training, they accelerate every time. And for a CEO or executive, that model can be applied, but it's different. And so many of the CEOs and executives come and they have a tremendous work ethic. But if you remember in this example, toughness is not a differentiator. So I think one of the areas that we help them find is, how do you find this sustainable performance, almost sustainable performance zone in many ways, where they get battle ready to adapt and adjust and evolve based on what is coming at them, whether it's a massive period of challenge in the workplace, a lot of travel, whatever it might be. And I think that intersection, as it applies for an executive, is at the heart of it, they have a lot of responsibility at the workplace. And when that's challenging, whether they need to be a leader, whether they need perspective, what they lose sight of quite often is the intersection of the absolute requirement to have two other buckets that ultimately are going to help them accelerate and become the best leaders. The one bucket is what I would call training. And you don't have to be an athlete, by the way, to embrace training. The only reason I use the word training is exercise is random, and nothing in life that you do random is going to yield results. Training is structured and progressive. So that's why I use that word. But the key components of training to develop resilience in an emotional and a physical sense, and then a big bucket of rejuvenation. For them to ultimately be the best leader possible, they have to have a set of positive habits, including sleep, including habits around fueling and nutrition, but also the chance to step away and have something for themselves. And many incoming executives fail to value those two components to ultimately enable them to be successful as a CEO. And you think about it, I live in San Francisco, all of these young tech entrepreneurs that still think that a requirement and a pathway to success is sleeping under the desk at night and coding until 3 o'clock in the morning. But ultimately, a lack of sleep is not a marker of toughness or success. It's a marker of performance stupidity. And so I think really helping them tie and join the dots together and create their recipe is the thing that actually creates the catalyst for them to be able to draw on their natural strengths as a leader, as a CEO in many ways.
Got it. And just picking up on one of the phrases that you've used a couple of times, toughness is not a differentiator. Say more, what's behind this?
Well, I think it's a mindset. We have this a lot with athletes. We have it a lot with CEOs. And I'll give you two great examples. In an athletic sense, if we have a young athlete that's on their quest, they want to become world champion. They know that the journey is going to be very challenging. And when they look at their heroes, and if they look at the commercials of their heroes, it's always the Rocky Balboa bursting through, you know, toughness, running on the beach as hard as you can. But the biggest weakness, the biggest mistake for world-class athletes is going too hard on the easy days. So always being turned on. And so therefore, we have to realize that in that very thin air of world-class performance, everyone is tough and everyone is relatively physically gifted. And so those two components are not the things that separate the champions from the ones that they also ran. And that's exactly the same for a leading executive, where tough everyone to be successful in life on a leading position, you have to have high work ethic. You have to be willing to go the extra mile, to be tough. But that's not the driver to success. And certainly that's not the differentiator. The differentiator is actually, when I think about toughness, I just get a picture of someone sitting in the weeds, getting up at 3 a.m, getting on the train to New York, going on the treadmill. But the great people actually have a real path, very mission focused, and have the ability to stop, pause, and come up out of the weeds in this great pursuit of consistency. And so it's not that toughness is not important. It's just that toughness is not a separator of the men from the boys.
Got it. Very, very well said. Moving on to a different theme, Matt, how do you think about expanding or strengthening the mental reservoir of strength that we need to leverage? And the reason I ask is in endurance sport, triathlons and related sports, it's a lot about the mind. So how do you think about systematically expanding that reservoir that people can draw on?
I think that confidence as a coach, you cannot develop confidence. You can set a pathway, you can be the driver behind it, but the quest is to put people in repeatable learning experiences. And when people become familiar and they see progress, confidence grows out of it. And so we're always looking for the opportunity to put them into what we always call successful challenge. In other words, challenging people, but not so that they fail, but so that they can just be successful and grow from it. Another component that confidence comes out of is really framing what success is and realizing, and in many ways, framing what failure is. Many people see so many life experiences and so many sporting experiences as being pass-fail. But we have success and we have opportunity for growth. And when we look at the most successful athletes every time, they are the athletes that have understood or developed the resilience and the tools to navigate failure. In fact, the one thing that's consistent is they've failed a heck of a lot. And so strength and confidence and mental resilience comes out of repeatable learning behaviors, developing the resilience of failure and the growth opportunities that come from it. I'll tell you, Deepak, when we have athletes that go to races, one of our phrases that we use is freedom to fail. So you've got an athlete that's stepping up into the world championships, and there's obviously a strategy behind how they're going to approach the race. But we say you have absolute freedom to fail. To many people, that sounds defeatist, but it's not. It's ultimately there are things you can control and cannot control. And in sport, we cannot ultimately determine success. What we can do is do everything that we can do in our power to give ourselves the best performance necessary. And if we do everything in our power and we don't win, that is successful failure, and that's an opportunity for growth. And so I think that the driver behind it is exposure, framing success, and then ultimately the one final component, and this carries from sport all the way across to life and, of course, into business development, realizing that underneath that, what I really said was embracing the journey. You can't rush it. And confidence comes out of wisdom and growth over time. It's never just going to arrive into an employee or into an athlete.
And back to these athletes who treat failure as a learning opportunity. Again, if I were to go beyond the, let's say, the cliches and dive into that moment in time, let's say somebody is prepared for a world championship, which comes maybe once in every few years. Mm-hmm. You've trained hard day in, day out, and then you have a bad day and you don't win a medal or you don't finish well. What is it about successful athletes, about how they process that moment, you know, the moment when they finish the race? Just sort of maybe double click on that for us and make it real for us in terms of how they process those moments when moments of truth, if you will.
I think the first thing to say is that it's really painful. And so when we talk about athletes becoming really really equipped to manage failure, it doesn't mean they like failure, and it doesn't mean that pain isn't there. And in fact, great athletes despise failure, and that's important. They want to win, but the key is that managing and adapting to it is learnable. It's a skill, and it fits within context. So the first thing that I'll say is that while we have these races, world championships, Olympic Games, components like that, the most successful athletes tend to be less outcome-driven with particular events or singular events and then singular races. Most athletes tend to be intrinsically driven to in the pursuit of finding their best performance. So that is a really empowering mindset. For a company, if the quest is, oh, I just want to take the company public, I want to take the company public, that tends to be a bit more outcome focused and ultimately less impactful than I want to create an absolutely amazing company that is going to have this impact for this reason, and I'm going to get immense satisfaction. And the byproduct of it might be that I go public, or the byproduct might be I win a world championship. And so the first component to it is framing why the athlete does what they do. And very, very few of the very best athletes across all sports think, I only do this sport to win a World Cup or to win an Olympic medal. They are on a personal quest to become great, and they love the sport and they love the journey. And I think that passion component is the first step of resilience. The second component then is really what you ask, what happens when you do have a really poor performance? And I think there's a phase or a series of phases that you go through. The first is to lean into the grieving of it. And so when an athlete has a bad race, the first thing that we avoid is immediate analysis, trying to find the solution or the reason for that failure within the first 48 hours, because it's impossible to think logically, think clearly, and objectively and analyze yourself and how you went into that race with a clear head when you have the pain that is there. So instead, we give, and we talk about this, the grieving process. We give you, for the athlete, 24 to 72 hours, depending on the size of the event or the impact that it's had on them, just to be, just to let it marinate. And then we go through and we do a really objective analysis. And I think this is really important, not just in failure, but also in success. Why did we succeed? And why did we fail? And when we think about that component, we look at, it really anchors on controllable and things that were out of your control. So did you do everything that was necessary that you were trained to do in order to be successful? And those are the areas that are actionable. So we always start with this thing, control what you can control, act on what you can impact. And an athlete is much better equipped to get over the grieving, get over the pain and move on if they have clarity in the areas that they can improve on next time and in areas that they can grow. They also are better equipped to retain motivation and get over the grieving as well if they acknowledge the areas that were just out of their control. They had equipment failure. Someone was better than them. The environment, something changed with the environment, whatever it might be. And so by differentiating between areas that you can control and impact and grow for next time, and then saying, look, this just happened, it's a much better bridge to move on to progress for next time.
And maybe just sticking to that, the way you debrief an outcome, whether it's a win or a loss, what are some of the things that you find to be in the blind spot of the athlete that sometimes you see but the athlete doesn't?
I think that many athletes have very short-term memories. In fact, we all have short-term memories. And when we think about the most common one that we have is if an athlete has had a highly inconsistent runway into the race, so much has gone wrong, and it doesn't mean that necessarily a wonderful performance can't come out of it. The first step for that athlete, if they have a challenging performance, is they consistently fail to self-reflect and in an objective way acknowledge or join the dots that maybe their preparation wasn't optimal. And the reason for that is a really good thing is self-belief and desire to be great. And so great athletes have the ability to ignore adversity and still drive forward. But when things don't go well, quite often they have a hard time joining the dots. And so when an athlete has failed or faced challenge, I think that the blind spot is that word perspective of coming up and being able to just say, let's not try and find a guilty party for the reason that your performance wasn't great. Let's actually paint a global picture. And that's incredibly hard for an athlete or an employee when they're so passionate and so motivated and so dedicated. It becomes a very challenging. And I think if there is the biggest impact of a coach, it's the ability to help the athlete come up for perspective and see the big picture. And it's an incredibly hard thing to do by yourself. But once you're taken on that journey, it's the most empowering and impactful thing that you can do as an athlete.
Got it. And just sticking with how one manages the mind, Matt, it's I'm not an elite athlete, but I train for a half marathon. I've run a few half marathons. And I find it's one thing to push hard during a sprint when you know you've got a minute to go or you've got a few seconds to go. But it's another when you've got to push yourself for a couple of hours, right? When you've got to keep pushing the limit moment by moment, while knowing that, you know, while ensuring that you don't deplete your reserves. So I'm curious about just how some of your athletes deal with their mind when they compete, and what's the narrative that's going on here for them to ensure that they're giving their best moment by moment while ensuring that they're not depleting their reserves.
You know, Deepak, if I throw that back at you before I answer it, if we removed a race from that discussion, and if you were asking me as a business leader, and you said, wow, there's a really big project for a business over the course of the coming years or time, we want to achieve this and it feels overwhelming. So how do we maximize our execution without depleting our reserves? There's a pretty direct impact there on business, yeah? And the reason that I start with that is it's interesting that many business leaders that are trained and equipped in a business sense to think about their businesses as the journey or the process, when it comes to their own athletics, and if you put them into a 10K or a half marathon or a marathon, they become like small children. They don't do a very good job of joining the dots and actually using the skills that are already there, that are already finely tuned, and just applying them to their sport. And so how do we actually do that? Well, you have a big problem, you have a big challenge. And the half marathon being a great example. So it's 21 kilometers, 13 miles. And there are several components. The first thing that you have to do, to keep it very, very simple, is process, not outcome. So breaking down that big challenge in front of you down to small projects. So how can I execute right now? So we break it down, a great example would be, into 5 kilometer pieces. And you're not thinking about the second 5 kilometers, the third 5 kilometers, the fourth 5 kilometers. You're thinking about, what do I need to do in this 5 kilometers that I'm in right now to maximize performance and to make sure that I'm managing my energy and to make sure that I'm pacing it as well as I can. And once that is over, I put it behind me and I start on the next project. So always breaking down the project into smaller projects so that you can execute and have intentional focus is number one. The second component is the same saying as we talk about failure. Control what you can control, act on what you can impact. And so things that have happened in the past when you're in a race, that's happened. And so you put that behind the ears because that's not necessary and you cannot impact that anymore. And what's going to happen in 10 kilometers outside of maybe fueling and hydration, you can't impact now that either. And so creating intentional focus in what you can control right now is the only way that you can ultimately build those projects and be successful. And we quite often always infer special forces in this, in the States, Navy SEALs, when they're going on hostage extraction or something like that, because there are all sorts of things that are going to happen. There are inevitable adversities that you're going to be faced, but control what you can control, act on what you can impact, only focus on the now so that ultimately you can build the overall place. And that is a trained skill. And that's actually a really healthy thing to go through as any human being to extend into life, and why doing things like sports is a really healthy thing.
And moving to a related theme, Matt, visualization, right? That's a term that one hears a lot about elite athletes. Talk to us about how you think about visualization and how, whether it's athletes or business leaders, how one can leverage the power of that in unlocking the potential.
Yeah, I think that it's a very broad subject, and it becomes something that is highly personal. And but I ultimately anchor it in a phrase that I really like a lot about creating confidence out of familiarity. And so with visualization, it is a pathway or a route for the athlete or the business leader to put themselves in situations so that they can become familiar, so that they can grow. And it's not hippy-dippy, it's not woo-woo at all. It's actually a really important component so that you can lessen the wall or the barrier when people actually have to execute. And so a lot of times, and it doesn't take much, it takes very small repeated exposures to actually have an impact where you can start to develop this familiarity. We actually quite often with very busy executives as well as our professional athletes, we tend to pair visualization with meditation. Again, another big word. There's absolutely no doubt that meditation is a performance enhancer. But really, when you think about meditation, it can mean very different things to very different people. And one of the habits, and we're very habit-driven, things that are repeatable and you just do, one of the habits for almost all of our executives and professional athletes is some form of meditation, and married with that is some form of visualization. And so I'll use myself as an example. Almost every day, I tend to take about a 7 to 15 minute, sounds very bizarre and a bit quirky, but about 7 to 15 minute quiet time. So you could call that a nap, you could call that visualization, you could call it meditation, but it's a time to empty your mind. For a professional athlete, we tend to use that time to take a piece of their performance. Maybe it's the start of the race at the swim when it's really chaotic. Maybe it's coming off of the bike onto starting a marathon. And we just have them sit quietly in a cool place that's dark. There's no screens. Their eyes are closed. And they visualize the actions that they're going to do in that environment. Now, the outcome might be that they fall asleep. And that's really rejuvenative from a physiological standpoint. The other component is they might not fall asleep, but they have a chance to actually put themselves in the situation and find familiarity. That's a wonderful performance-enhancing habit. And whether it's just quiet time and you don't fall asleep, or whether you actually fall out of visualization, do fall asleep, then you're getting a spike of growth hormone and having much better energy in the rest of the day. It's a very simple habit. And so I think I answered two questions there. What it is, and then second, how do we implement it? And so I think I went on the journey there, Deepak, but I hope that makes sense.
No, that's all good. No, I wanted to pick up on one of the things that you mentioned, Matt, a couple of times, right, that you're habit-driven. One of the pieces I've been thinking about is, you know, being habit-driven versus developing a perspective on the context that's emerging, and therefore having the ability to overrule the habit and do what's appropriate for that context. I don't know if this sounds too vague, but I just wonder, how do you think about habit as a, you know, at some level, habit could also mean you get conditioned and you don't apply your judgment moment to moment on what makes sense. So how do you think about developing that ability to overrule a habit if the context demands something else?
It's a great question, and I think that is critical. I think that judgment, smart judgment in a situation comes out of empowerment, but successful judgment is going to come from ultimately from first having a set of positive habits or ways of doing. And so first let's unpack habits globally. Why am I so habit-driven? Why do I encourage athletes to have habits? And if we just think about health or performance and every component of it, sleep, nutrition, approach to training, so everything that sort of really impacts my world, each one of those creates an explosion of rabbit holes and competing information and confusing impacts. What are the best ways to eat? Keto diet, vegan, yada, yada, yada. There's every sort of great solution. And so we always talk about the blizzard of bullshit. And so really the reason that we care so much about habits is that, and we have a saying at Purple Patch, nail the basics. with a professional athlete, there are seven main basic things that we want to repeatedly and always impact or execute as a habit. And if they can get those seven things right, they're 95% of the way there. And so that's why what we're really looking to do is to diffuse distraction and to create intentional focus. And it's very habit driven. We're not trying to turn people into monks. We're not trying to have them go down every little pathway possible to theoretically incrementally help. What are the building blocks that we can move the performance needle and help people be successful? And it's always very simple things that are central. And so that's why we anchor on habits. And when you get those right, when you embrace recovery, when you consume calories after exercise so that we can minimize stress and impact your food selection for the rest of the day and facilitate portion control, you start to put the person, whether it's a world-class athlete, whether it's an executive, into control. So that's what habits do, is they empower and enable control. But then you've got this better vehicle to navigate in. Then it's what you're asking about, awareness and adjustment and perspective. And so I think that habits are things that you do, but they're really sort of actions you take to put yourself in the best footing possible. But it's consistently being able to then make judgment off of situations that occur that come out of that in many ways. I don't know if that answers your question, but I think that that's the mindset that we take on it.
No, that makes sense. And moving to another topic around the mind, Matt, one hears a lot about the wall, right? Especially in endurance sports, people hitting a wall. I'm curious about how you think about harnessing the power of the mind in dealing with these situations. How do you get your mind, or how do you get yourself to push forward when the body is asking it to give up? So double click on that for us in terms of how people can learn from endurance sport and how athletes deal with the wall when it hits them.
There's no better analogy than the emotional and physical impact of going through one of the toughest physical challenges that there is in endurance sport, an Ironman. And mm-hmm. one of the mistakes that people make, and it's ironic because we come to this topic after talking about visualization. Visualization is really sort of, it sounds really positive and it's almost dreamy. We visualize ourselves as being robust and resilient and strong, and we visualize our race performance as being free of adversity. But the first step in developing the emotional resilience to navigate the wall or a complete breakdown is first acknowledging that adversity is inevitable. And so even if we think about an Ironman at the professional level, that takes 8 to 9 hours, depending on if you're a male or female. And for regular everyday amateurs, it takes 9, 10, 11, 12, up to 17 hours. If we think about just our energy in a regular day, we have massive ebbs and flows of times that we feel like we're thriving and feeling really good, other times that we can barely keep our eyes open. And those sensations are going to occur over the course of an Ironman event, but magnified times 100. And so what we have to first realize is that adversity is a part of performance. And you will have times where you feel like you can't go on, where you feel like you're breaking down. And what it comes back to is first acknowledging and realizing that it is not the end when this occurs. And I think what happens with many people is the first sign of adversity, the first sign of physically breaking down, they move forward and they think, goodness me, I'm 20 kilometers in. I still have 22 kilometers to go. And their mind jumps to, how am I ever going to finish this? I'm just going to feel terrible from now on. This is the start of the decay. and people fall into a defeatist mindset. But it comes back to that saying, control what you control, act on what you can impact. And so we have athletes do two things. The first is to take physical action. So physical action is often you need to take sugar very quickly in a sporting context, and we need to change your rhythm, whatever it might be. So if you're dragging yourself through a marathon, you need to change your rhythm, you need to change your speed. And that sometimes is bizarrely speeding up for a short period of time to change the rhythm. Sometimes it's taking a walk break or whatever that might be. But in the mental component, it comes back to what can I control right now and what can I impact, and having the wisdom to realize this is how I am feeling right now. It is normal, but I have to now shorten those mini projects we talked about before to become very, very short. So in an athletic mindset is I need to do the next mile or the next kilometer and nothing else. And the driving point behind it is I think that when you have the wall, being open to feeling good again. And when athletes just double down on themselves and they take some physical impact and they're patient, their body can be open to coming back. So, and I think the one other thing that I think is really important with this is the word pain. And pain is a part of this. And I'm sure in your half marathons, you've experienced pain. It's not a very pleasant thing. But the relationship with pain from an emotional standpoint is a key component of navigating times of adversity, or as you call it, the wall. Because pain is a response to your hard work, to your effort, to you doing something very special. And so we always talk to athletes about having a conversation with yourself when you're under pain. And rather than trying to push pain away and say, goodness me, I don't want to have pain, I don't want it to impact, instead, you actually say, this is normal, this is anticipated, and this is a result of the hard work and doing something really positive. And when you start to shift it from being, oh no, I'm in pain, I must be struggling, and this is going to be really hurtful, to pain is actually a byproduct of me doing something really special, it helps build that resilience and confidence to keep pushing through.
It's interesting. You talk about pain. Maybe if we stick with that for a couple of minutes, and not talking about elite athletes, but let's say time-starved CEOs you work with. At some level, it's also about listening to your body and ensuring that you don't do any damage to your body long-term.
Yeah.
So where do you draw the line between bearing pain and pushing through versus, you know, being pragmatic, listening to your body and saying, you know, maybe I'm doing some long-term damage here and cutting your losses. Do you come up with that situation?
Yeah, a lot of, I mean, pain can express itself in many different ways. So when, you know, when someone is in a race, pain is a natural byproduct that we expect, and you don't cut your losses there. You absolutely maximize what you're looking to do. But on a chronic level, on a day-to-day level, there are two things to unpack here. What is good pain and what is not good pain? And that becomes a key component of staying healthy. And in fact, I would also say you could transplant the word pain with fatigue. What is good fatigue and what is negative fatigue? And I think that the question is it anticipated or not anticipated? Is it isolated or is it global? So when we're talking about pain, if you're working very, very hard and it hurts physically, but it hurts across your body or it hurts in the areas that you expect it to, if you're on a rowing machine, your legs and your arms are aching and they're sore and it's hurting, or your breathing is very challenging, that's anticipated, that's normal, that's an outcome that you would expect. There's no reason to back off. But if it's isolated and it's sharp and it's on one leg or on the Achilles or on the knee, that's, are you actually doing benefit or are you breaking down structurally? And I think the same occurs with fatigue. Many people say, ask the question, when should you push through and when should you back off? Well, a key component of training globally is to stress the body and achieve positive adaptations. Your body will always adapt, but is it adapting by getting stronger and growing and evolving? Or is it going into metabolic overstress? Is it going down to where you're going to pull a hamstring muscle or something along those lines? It comes back to, is it anticipated or not? And so with an athlete, if they're on a training camp, there's anticipated fatigue and you push through. But for a very busy executive that's training, it's not that we need to be fearful of fatigue, but we have to be able to come out of perspective and say, is this session going to lead for me to be able to grow and adapt and evolve? Am I going to be successful? And it really ties in many ways, Deepak, to that toughness is not a differentiator, because the best athletes, the best executives have the courage to recover when necessary so that they can ultimately grow.
Got it. And just maybe segueing into another theme, burnout, right? Given business leaders that come to you already possibly have an all-consuming life, how do you ensure that by adding this, let's say training for elite sports or physical training, doesn't consume them further? You know, how do you think about rest? I think you spoke about rejuvenation along the way, but talk to us a little bit about what are some of the pitfalls that leaders fall into as they think about rest or rejuvenation.
I think that you just fell into it in many ways, which was adding something in. And so what was sort of inferred there was you're taking something like training or sport or whatever it might be, and you're dumping it on top of life. So, and that will always yield failure. It would always yield underperformance, the accumulation of stress and fatigue. And so the biggest mistake that we see people make is to think, I know I need to exercise because I know that's something to do that makes me really healthy. So how am I going to just add this on top of life? And many people, what they do, and a great example is, oh, it's wonderful, I've got a bunch of friends, I'm going to do Ironman Turkey and it sounds wonderful. And they, what does it take to train for that? And it takes 20 hours a week. Goodness me, I don't have 20 hours a week, but there's the training program and that's what I need to do. I'm going to dump it on top of life and I'm just going to have to find a way to cram it in. To be successful and to actually integrate the key components of rejuvenation and recovery, as well as training, what we have to realize is that we have to integrate it into a person's life so that not only can they improve in that discipline, because hopefully they're looking for improvement, but so that it can lift their health, it can lift their performance as a CEO or an executive, and it can help them thrive across all areas of life. And so it's all about integration. We go through a very particular process where we look at their habits at the start and we look at their genuine landscape of their life. What are the non-negotiables? And when we think about non-negotiables, there's obviously the commitments in the workplace. Quite often there's the commitment with their family and we want them to be available and present for their family, their children, their wives, their husbands, whatever it might be. And then the other component that we have as non-negotiable is sleep. And saying, okay, how much are you sleeping? Is that necessary? And is it high enough quality, which is the other component of effective sleep, not just quantity? Are you getting enough? And with those building blocks in life, we have a certain amount of time left over. And that ebbs and flows with the different demands of life. But then we can go about saying the equation, with that time that is left over, how do we optimize it? How do we create an optimization mindset with that time that's left over? And that's a very different way of going about it. So rather than just dumping a training program on top of life or throwing a bunch of habits and saying, this is how you have to navigate, it becomes an all-encompassing recipe for them. And that's really where development of resilience and ultimately success comes from.
No, that's a great point. I think you're right. It's the way you frame it, right? I think you're right. I fell into the trap of framing it as one thing on top of other things. I think that point is well taken. But just maybe picking on one of the things you said, Matt, sleep, and maybe getting very tactical here.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think about sleep, both from a quantity and a quality perspective? If you could give us a sense of what are some of the guidelines here?
Yeah.
And back to your point, there's a lot of blizzard of bullshit around. I'd love to get your take on it.
Sure. And I think we have to first acknowledge, I'll give you a very practical guide or takeaways for people. And the first thing is there is an individual and a genetic component to it. And so not everyone is the same. Some people are a morning lark, some people are night owls. And I think that for listeners, understanding yourself and understanding, are you someone that tends to perform better when they go to bed early and get up early, or stay up later and get to sleep in a little bit later, and trying to mesh life with that natural quality. There's also a genetic component of how much sleep you actually need. Some people can thrive or do better on less hours of sleep, but no one that I've ever met, and the research will actually support this as well, no one that I've met consistently thrives on having less than 7 hours sleep every night. And most people begin with 4, 5, or 6 hours when they've got very busy lives. It's consistently underdone. Some people need 8 or 9 hours. And of course, that's a challenge for us as adults with everything that we have in our life. But it's not as simple as just saying how many hours. The key component to it is, how do you set yourself up for perhaps more important, how do you set yourself up for the best quality of sleep possible? And a part of that is environment, and a part of it is approach and habits. There goes that word habits again. So with environment, the body tends to perform best when it's sleeping and get the best quality sleep when it's in a dark environment. It's cool, so the body tends to rejuvenate better in a cool environment and a quiet environment. Now, you can simulate that by wearing an eye pillow, wearing earplugs, and all of that is absolutely fine. But the cool, dark environment is really important. That's number one. But then secondly, there are some habits that people can do to help set themselves up for sleep. So ensuring that you're not using screens, or if you are using screens, you're using a blue blocker over the top of the screen in the last hour or two before. So I shifted to a habit where I like to read to try and turn my brain off just before I fall asleep. But rather than reading it on the iPad, I read paperback. I've gone back to old school because I want to avoid screen, any type of screen. The second component is ensuring that if you have a very, very busy mind and you have a bunch of things that you have to do, or think that you tend to get woken up in the middle of the night with considerations of, oh my goodness me, I've got to do A, B, C, and D tomorrow. It's really effective if you just keep a notepad by the bed, or just before you go to bed, you do what we call on a weekly basis the Sunday special, going through what you're going to do tomorrow to enable you to start in execution mode. And you do this on a weekly basis. You can also do it, if you tend to have broken sleep, on a nightly basis, a daily basis. And by doing that before you go to bed, it tends to settle the mind, because it tends to enable you to say, I can actually put this aside. I'm going to do this tomorrow. I will be in execution mode. And there's a much lower propensity for you to get woken up in night. And so those are some of the quick habits that we talk about. But we think about it equally in terms of quantity. But in many ways, more importantly, quality of sleep is really quite critical.
Lovely. We could go on and on, Matt, but I'm mindful of time. This podcast is titled Play to Potential. And you spoke about athletic potential and human potential. So I'd love to conclude it by getting your thoughts in summary. When you think about the phrase play to potential, what occurs to you?
Say two things. I love the word excellence, and in many ways that sits up there with potential. But for me, that's a that doesn't necessarily mean, when you think about potential, that doesn't mean world class. It doesn't mean being better. It's a very personal thing. Personal growth, personal development, and embracing a journey where you're always looking to improve and grow. And if you do that, I think that you're ultimately going to be fulfilled. You're going to be happier, and you're going to be the most successful and best version of yourself that you can be. And for me, that's really inspiring. So that's what I think about.
Lovely. Matt, pleasure having you on the podcast. Thanks so much for making the time.
Thanks so much, Deepak. Really enjoyed it. Wonderful conversation.
Likewise. I hope you found the conversation purposeful. Three things really struck me in this entire conversation. First is the point Matt makes about the coachability of the coach. People often ask me why I do this podcast, given there's an abundance of self-development content out there. To be candid, it actually comes from a place of curiosity, apart from the fact that I'm creating a body of content which is hopefully of value to the wider community. My primary intent, if I were to be honest, is to actually go on a learning and development journey over the long term and talk to people across adjacencies, sportsmen, artists, coaches, CEOs, thought leaders, and more. And it's a real privilege to learn from these conversations. It's also been immensely fulfilling to connect the dots across the various conversations and form patterns and bring them to bear in the coaching work I do. As Matt says, each coaching journey is a two-way conversation. For me, each of the individuals I've worked with and each of the podcast conversations has been a great opportunity for me to reflect and grow. If you've listened to a few conversations at the podcast, hopefully you feel the same way too. The other point I would make in this context is that when I come across as coachable or open to input with my clients or coaches, it does deepen the trust levels in the relationship, and that in turn drives up the effectiveness of the coaching journey. Second thing that struck me was the point he makes about toughness not being a differentiator at the top. In my work, I find that there are several type A leaders that I come across who are built tough, who are competitive, and race through the first 10-15 years of their career. But when it comes to the second half, I see a lot of them crash and burn. And I've noticed that in the upper echelons of the corporate hierarchy, it does matter how thoughtful you are, how you deal with disagreement, how nuanced you are in your thinking, how you read a political situation, how you handle multiple egos, and so on. And the Rocky Balboa approach that Matt speaks about starts breaking down around mid-career when people start making the transition into the upper levels of the corporate hierarchy. The third thing that really struck me was that one needs to have a fine balance between being habit-driven and being contextually aware. Being too far at either end of the spectrum is not ideal. Being blindly habit-driven makes us a Pavlovian dog. And being completely flexible and responsive to context sends us down multiple rabbit holes. And to use Matt's words, there's a risk of getting lost in the blizzard of BS. So that balance of habit and awareness is key. And this is something that came up in my conversation with the mythologist Devdutt Patnaik as well. If this topic is of interest, you might want to listen to him. Thank you for listening. If you find the content of value, please rate the show and write a review on iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you consume this content. To access tailored, bite-sized modules from our various conversations, you could visit the curated playlist section at playtopotential.com. The next podcast conversation that I will publish is with Professor Herminia Ibarra of London Business School.
In career transition, it's a little bit different. It is oftentimes, you have to let the process go for a while before you actually start to get the ahas of what you're trying to do and what you're really running away from and what you would really like instead. It's not all that obvious at first. And so it takes going through the process. But what happens is people get kind of nervous once it's been a few months or, you know, gosh, you know, what's it going to look like on my CV? And I'm meeting the same people and they're saying, oh, are you still on that sabbatical? Or, you know, and it feels quite not right. And so they can sabotage themselves because it feels like they're being idle when in fact, maybe what they're doing is just recouping, gathering forces, incubating ideas. They haven't found the right thing yet, but that time can be quite necessary, even if it's uncomfortable to go through it.
I look forward to having you at one of the subsequent conversations at the Play to Potential podcast. Bye now.